We are looking at the episodes of the crucifixion, and this is so crucial to the whole history of mankind. We want to pull that into focus. Usually the crucifixion is looked at as a very large series of episodes. He did this and he did that, and they did this and they did that, and so forth. But you've got to look at it as sort of a turning point in the history of mankind, and a moment of almost cataclysm. It was a dramatic moment in the history of the world. And we have to kind of look at it like that, and see all the facets of it. Because surrounding the crucifixion were a lot of other matters. The betrayal, for example. But also the so-called Last Supper. Actions of the Pharisees. And, of course, Pilate. A very important episode within the process of the crucifixion. But we hear about it so much, the crucifixion, and so much made of it, which is right, especially in the Catholic Church, a great deal is made of crucifixion. It's sort of the centerpiece of the whole church, because the Mass is all based around the crucifixion. It's sort of a sacrifice of the Mass. Mass is a sacrificial reenactment of the crucifixion of Christ. And of course, the crucifixes are there always with the body of Jesus on them and so forth. So, and much is made of the sufferings of Jesus. A good deal is made of that. So, it's a turning point in the history of mankind. So much is made of it that it almost becomes commonplace. Without stopping to realize all the aspects of it, the impact of it, what it's all about. And, of course, you have to understand that the early history of the Jews, right up until the coming of Christ, was a history of redemptive rituals and feasts and so forth, you know, sacrifices. And the focus is on the fact that mankind was separated from God and now has to find a way or has a way to get back to Him. That was a fundamental point from Genesis to Revelation. Because even in Genesis, in 3:15, you have the statement about the beginning of redemption where the serpent comes and it says that the serpent will attack the seed of the woman, and you will bruise the serpent's head. He will bruise your heel. In other words, a rather cryptic statement to the effect that the whole world will be in the jaws of Satan, or in the clutches of Satan. And that the only salvation, or the only hope for that, is that God has His way of handling Satan. Fundamental to the whole crucifixion concept is that sin entered the world. And again, let me reiterate that the Edenic episode of Eve and the so-called apple. But it troubles me, as I'm sure it troubles others, to think in terms of the whole race being cursed and devastated as a result of one act of disobedience. However, that act might have offended God, I think. We've discussed that, but you may encounter people who have trouble trying to accommodate that idea that God should be so merciless as to destroy the race over one little disobedience. Of course, people say, well, after all, if you get a parking ticket and you don't show up at the appointed hour, they can come and arrest you. Now, people will use that as an example of why taking that fruit was a serious thing, because it was a disobedience to God. That still doesn't, in my own mind, satisfy the whole issue. Or let me say, I understand why people would feel uneasy about that. It would seem a very severe penalty for one disobedience. Therefore, as I have pointed out to you, from other passages in the Scripture, as for example in Ezekiel 30, maybe 31, we have a mention of the trees of the garden of God. And in 28 of Ezekiel, we have a mention of the Syrian king of Tyre as being a tree in the garden of God. And so I've concluded from a number of such references that these trees in Ezekiel are identified as world rulers who were representative of Satan, maybe his agents along with him in the Garden of Eden. But the implications are, and of course, especially when you see the perplexing problem of Cain, let us assume that the standard understanding here is that, or the standard interpretation of the Bible, is that Adam and Eve were put out of the garden, then they had two sons, Cain and Abel. And Cain slew Abel and was then sent off because of his killing of Abel. And it says he went to the land of Nod and he took a wife. Now, just look at the picture. If Adam and Eve were the first man and woman, and Cain and Abel were the first children of Adam and Eve, what's he doing over in the land of Nod? You know, what's going on over there? So I conclude from that, plus anthropological studies, the story in the book of Genesis is more symbolic than literal, in the sense that that the trees in the garden of God might have been symbolic of personalities who later followed Satan and became his demonic creatures, beings, and that there was a fairly significant history of things there between some of the verses in Genesis 3. So you could perhaps look at it and say that Eve's partaking of the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil was tantamount to getting mixed up with a culture of that time that was pagan. If there was such a pagan culture, I don't know. But if I should stand before the Lord and he says, why were you teaching such tommy rot? Well, I said, just because I'm a human fool, you know, I understand that. So in other words, what I'm saying is, if it has to be the other way, it's all right with me. I'm not going to throw God over just because I don't understand the Garden of Eden. But I think it is important to understand the possibilities. I think the problems of assuming that Cain and Abel were the first and only descendants of Adam and Eve, who were the only creatures on the earth, are pretty heavy. You've got too much of a problem. And yet, from anthropological studies, we understand that there were some very significant cultures in the world as early as 2500 BC. But suffice it to say, there was more to that episode in the Garden of Eden than merely picking a piece of fruit and eating it in disobedience to God. Disobedience to God is not a light thing. But that one episode of disobedience hardly comports with God's discussion of his mercy. To have devastated the race over that one act of disobedience seems to me a little heavy. However it happened, the race of mankind was nevertheless tainted by the fall and has produced a race of persons on the earth that are subject to a very inadequate handling of life. Everywhere you go, it's an inadequate handling of life. I don't care where you are, who you're talking to. Human beings are just no damn good, you know. Human beings are a problem to themselves and to the people around them. I have to say to you that the the results of the so-called fall, whatever they were, or however they occurred, these have left the race of mankind with a considerable problem. These problems keep us crowded to Christ. What would we do if we didn't have Russia or China or our own politicians on Capitol Hill or our husbands, not to say wives? What would we have? We didn't have all those problems. Well, we would be pretty independent, I think. I think we would not pay a whole lot of attention to Christ. But these perennial weaknesses, which we have to deal with and live with, are always there and always keep us coming back to Christ for help. So we will wind up in the grave as weak as we were when we were born. Some people say you're going to push up the posies. You may just be too weak to push up the posies. Well, a human frame and a human person is fraught with weakness, but what that does is keep us constantly reliant upon Christ to help us function with some degree of perspicacity and equanimity in this world. All right, now, in view of all of that human failure and frailty, God evolved the sacrificial system, which took the form of animal sacrifices. If a nuisance, nevertheless effective. And people have said, well, God is a bloody God. And I've said, well, sin is a bloody event. the world is a bloody world. So you need a bloody response to the bloody world. And that's where sacrifices come in. The awfulness of human sin, the awfulness of the sacrifice, was constantly before the people of Israel. You take an animal and slay it, and the priest slays the animal in front of you, it's an ugly thing. But sin is ugly. Now, when Jesus came to be the ultimate sacrifice, it was an ugly event. There's no question about the ugliness of the crucifixion. The slaying of animals was an ugly thing. We're in a position of total dependence upon the great high priest, Christ, to take care of this sacrifice for us. So more than just becoming an Aaronic priest who continued to offer sacrifices to the people, he became the sacrifice himself and ended all sacrifice. So now we come to Christ with our sin and with our failures and so forth. And the whole process of identity with Christ and forgiveness of sins and confession and so forth keeps us always mindful of sin. Every day of our lives, we are mindful of sin. Because every day of our lives we face inadequacies, weaknesses, problems from ourselves or others. Of course, there's always other people that are a problem to us, not we to them. We're confronted by the failures and weaknesses of human beings. And it keeps us sensitive to Christ. And therein lies our ultimate salvation, is openness to Christ, because we have no place else to go. Now, the matter of sin is something that has to be unfolded to us as we go along. Now, people who try to get someone to confess their sin before they can be saved, I have a problem, because if someone said to me, you have to be penitent for the sin of Adam 2,000 or 4,000 years ago, I'd have to tell them they're crazy. How can I be sorry for something somebody did 4,000 years ago? Well, the result is that confession becomes a pretty mechanical thing, see, and people write out their salvation syndrome or pattern or whatever it is, and people go over that, you know, and I'll say after me A, B, C, and D, and people say that so they can be saved, but it's all pretty much of a farce, because a person coming newly to Christ may not have any sense of sin at all. He doesn't come because he feels he's such a great sinner, unless he's just committed a lot of sins. I remember long ago, I was going through my experiences with the typical salvation process, you know, the confessional and the ritual at the altar and all that sort of thing. And I went through all of that and learned the hard way, you know, what was a fallacy in it. But I remember this fellow that a serviceman up in Seattle came forward in a meeting, and I was involved in the counseling situation. And he was all very, very upset with himself because he had taken a woman home the night before. Apparently married, I think he probably was, but he had taken this woman home. Well, this was what was really bugging him and disturbing him. Well, okay, I can see if a fellow does something like that, then he might feel some remorse, probably more remorse because the whole situation was bitter and not because he really, I wouldn't be surprised what he would do it again that night. But there was no sense that I could see from him that he was really desolate over the sin of Adam. See what I'm saying? And people come to Christ because their life is falling apart or whatever. But a lot of people I've dealt with, maybe most of the people I deal with, are not that ready to deal with or talk about the meaning of sin. And I've always said, until they come to Christ, how can they really know? See, only the Spirit can make real to them the meaning of sin. Well, then after they come to Christ, and they begin to find out who Christ is and relate themselves to him, only then do they really have a sensitivity to what sin is all about. The sacrifice of Christ was effective for the sin of the world, but nothing is said about how sorry people ought to be for that sin. But there are other things that draw them to Christ. I'm not condoning sin. I'm just saying there are things, other things that draw them to Christ. And after they've come to Christ, then he begins to deal with them about specific kinds of problems. Salvation, according to John, is by receiving Christ. The efficacy of the crucifixion of Christ is the basis of our salvation, and not how sorry we are for what we are or what we've done. So salvation is merely coming to Christ, not necessarily coming with some particular kind of emotional or theological formula. All right, now, the world was locked in darkness at the time Jesus came. Even the sacrifice, the system that had been ordained for the children of Israel for so many years, was weak and ineffective, and not being offered for the most part with any kind of real sensitivity. I think the faithful remnant offered their sacrifices. Now, you know, Mary came with her doves for Christ, concerning Christ. And I think they believed in that. The Pharisees went through their rituals without any real sensitivity to them. And Jesus said, you're white on the outside and inside full of dead men's bones. So I suspect that the Pharisees, according to what we can read in the Gospels, were fairly correct in their offering of the sacrifice. In other words, there was nothing that Jesus had to say to them that meant that they were not properly offering the sacrifices, but it was the spirit in which they offered them that was the problem, that they did not offer them with faith, and therefore they were rejected by God. But the faithful remnant who had to come through these priests were personally involved in it and personally honest and sincere about their offering. All right, well, then Now, the whole thing is now at the time of Christ's coming weak and almost non-existent. Finally, in a few years, it goes out the window, because after the sacking of Rome by Titus, I think that was about the end of the sacrificial offerings. Now comes Christ. At his death on the cross, it says that the veil of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom, thus opening up the very presence of God to the people. So that's the main thrust of this crucifixion. We want to go back and pick up a lot of details here, but the main thrust is that God provided his own Lamb, Jesus, who became the Lamb of God, to take away the sin of the world. And sin was totally, completely, efficaciously rendered harmless by that act, especially for those who will receive it. No longer is the world locked in a sin that is untouchable or unreachable. God has provided the way out, the way of escape, and all who come to him have an automatic deliverance from sin. All right, now in the setting up of this crucifixion and the circumstances surrounding it, you have a good number of details that are important, because after all, this is the crucial moment in the history of mankind. Luke and John and Mark, all of them deal with this crucifixion. All of them present different aspects of it, and all of them in many ways informative. But they did not dwell on the nature of Jesus' punishment. Today, in many circles, especially, let's say, in the Catholic Church, there's a great thing made of the nature of Jesus' punishment, the brutality with which Jesus was crucified. The New Testament gives a couple of verses to that. But many books have been written describing in detail how they went about crucifying Jesus. And I would think Jesus would be very much embarrassed if he read that, that they should put so much focus on it. And even in the Roman Church and some others, they feel that the more they can feel the sufferings of Christ, the more credit they get, which is almost an insult, because it's someone saying, I am capable of suffering as much as you. Let's say now that you've got some friend that's in cancer, and they're lying in their bed in great pain. Now you want to share this with them, so you get a bed, put it alongside their bed, and you put rocks in the bed. And then you lie down on it and say, see, I want you to know I can suffer too. It's absurd. Idiotic. You have no idea how they are personally suffering. And to try to duplicate that suffering is an insult, because it supposes that anybody can do what you're doing, see? Dwelling on the particular brutishness of the way that Jesus was treated in the crucifixion can only be, in many respects, derogatory in nature, because for humans to think they can describe his sufferings minimizes his suffering. So discussing the crucifixion of Jesus is not valid in discussing it to try to duplicate in any kind of description what Jesus suffered. In fact, I think the suffering of Christ was more prolonged in the years on the earth as a human being, feeling the pains and the stresses and frustrations of earth. See, it's the same thing as, let's say, a person has gone through a great many years, maybe 30 years of great distress in their lives, and maybe the loss of loved ones and financial destitution, and just pile it up, physical pains and destitution and the loss of family and whatever. Now they come to the end of their lives and they have a few weeks of of suffering, say with cancer or something like that, and you say to them, oh, this must be the worst part of your life, and they're going to say, no, by no means. I mean, I had 30 years of misery. This is nothing. You might say that about Jesus, that the years he spent on the earth, frustrated with human inadequacy and inanity, idiocy, may have been more a suffering to him than the moment on the cross. So often you hear him say to his disciples, have I been with you so long and you still feel this way? You know what's the matter with you jerks? Why didn't you learn? You know, you feel at the end, you know, and that plaintive cry in John 6, you know, everybody left Jesus. Here he's standing with these 12 disciples, and he says, will you also go away? And all they can say is, well, we don't have any place else to go. If we had some place else, we'd go there. Where are we going to go? Yeah, so the idea of I'm with you because I don't know where else to go is not really all that complimentary. These are things that must have pained Jesus deeply. The episode of the crucifixion was in reality an episode. A very unpleasant one, a very agonizing one. He'd had 30-some years on the earth of frustration and distress, and heartache, sorrow, so forth. He was called a man of sorrows. Why was he called a man of sorrows? Well, because everywhere he went, he was sorrowful. Weeping on some occasions, distressed over the condition of the people, and distressed over their unbelief, and so on. It was a miserable time for him on the earth, if you will. Contrary to certain religious groups today, whom I will not mention, that might have said, well, Jesus, you know, the problem with you is you're just not shouting victory enough. You know? You ought to be more positive, Jesus. Take the power of positive thinking. I have thinking of some religious leader that would feel that Jesus was just not thinking of possibilities, possibility thinking. But I wouldn't mention any names. Anyway, we come to the episodes of the crucifixion, but there are surrounding events, and one of them we looked at last week with Mary, who anointed his feet and also then his hair with this alabaster of expensive perfume, the tremendous sacrifice for her, and you have at the same time the crystal clear, if not acid clear, reality of Jesus' remark to Judas. When Judas said, why didn't we sell this and give it to the poor? And Jesus said, the poor you have always with you, but me you do not have always. So he wasn't misled by sentimentalities. The point is, you can't do it all. You know, you have to do what you can do. You have to do what the Lord gives you to do, whatever that is. And that you can keep going with. The whole process of humanity on the earth is totally absurd unless you have your touch with Christ and you do day by day what he wants you to do. There's no way you can handle it. I don't know how to solve the problems of the world, as I've said. I don't know how to save anybody. All I know is that I read the Word and I follow Christ as best I can, do what he tells me to do, as far as I can do that. Okay, so here was the woman who broke the alabaster of perfume over his feet or poured it out over his feet. Then comes the Passover feast. And Jesus tells the disciples how to put it together. He says, my time is at hand. I will keep the Passover. And so he did, of course, and the disciples went out and made preparation for it. Of course, you have your artwork by Leonardo da Vinci, The Last Supper, which is unfortunately unreliable. Because he shows fish and loaves of bread rather than lamb and flatbread. It has been captured. The Last Supper has been captured in many different photo, much artwork, for example. The the point comes here that Jesus said while they were reclining there, somebody's going to betray me. And they said, who? And Jesus said, well, if I dip the morsel of food and hand it to him, that's the one that's going to betray me, which he did. And afterward, the disciples were all confused. They didn't know who it was that was going to betray him. It was rather a disturbing point where Jesus really notified them or identified the fellow that was going to betray him, but they couldn't get the picture at all for some reason. So after Judas received this morsel, we call it a sop because that means a morsel that's dipped and eaten, and he handed him Judas the sop, and it says in John that at that point Satan entered into Judas. At that point. And then he went out and did his deed. The question comes up, when did Satan enter into Judas? Was he originally set to be destroyed by this act? Well, apparently it wasn't fixed. But Satan didn't enter into him till he received that sop from Christ. It may be that up to that time he could have changed his mind. I don't know that. But it's a very unusual situation there where Jesus hands him the sop and he says, go and do whatever you're going to do, do it quickly. And Judas went out. Now the disciples are all puzzled and perplexed. They don't know who's going to do it. It's so typical to me of the many, many messages I've given, and I'm often astounded at what people have given back. You know, this is what I'm supposed to have said. I don't even recognize it. I somehow got it twisted. And that's what it was with Jesus. You know, there was such a lot of dullness of hearing there. Well, I think we'll stop at that point and pick it up next week.